Okay, so in extensive consultations about today's topic, which you may have witnessed during the Unatana Togef, we decided that what would make most sense is not just to talk about tshuva, but really about how one best uses this time of year. Because there are things, both out of the tradition and I think also out of just common wisdom for those who've gone through this in a serious way, that would be worth thinking about and sharing. So let me begin by asking you, if someone comes to you and says, I want to do tshuva, where do I start? Where do you start with them?
So the first place I start is by pointing out that this season began not really with Rosh Hashanah. It began the Saturday night prior to Rosh Hashanah with a service called Slichot, which means forgiveness. Slichot is about forgiveness, and the reason the tradition kind of gives away the shop at the very beginning is only if you're secure in being loved can you risk going out of your comfort zone. So the first thing I want to tell all of us is that what empowers us to do real tshuva, to be self-critical and honest, is the fact that we know we're forgiven. That's done, it's taken care of, you're loved and you're forgiven. The second thing is the tradition teaches us God cannot abide in a place that is dishonest. And so that means we have to be honest with ourselves. We have to be able to look at ourselves as we truly are. And we have to be able to face our recurrent shortcomings and be able to try to address those. And the third and final general piece of advice I would offer is that one of the great engines of monotheism is that it forces us outside of our own perspective. Right? So if your brain is like mine, most of the time what you end up doing is playing the same loop over and over and over again. So I tell myself the same story, which is frankly all the time y'all have let me down or offended me or disappointed me, and I'm always telling that story from my perspective. But if you take seriously that this is the time that God draws close, then at some point during the next 10 days, you have to ask yourself, not how does the story look from my vantage point, but how does it look from God's vantage point? And that reframing the story can pull us out of our own closed circle and look at it from a different perspective. I think those are the three keys. Know that you're loved, be able to rise outside of your own perspective, and stand in a place of truth.
There was a very interesting editorial in this morning's New York Times that talked about whether when someone believes something very firmly, and are presented with contrary evidence in a calm, rational, thoughtful way, what it tends to do in studies is just reinforce the belief that they already have. Unless it comes from somebody who shares their belief and is also contradicting it. So if, for example, somebody stands here and tells you everything that's wrong with Judaism, it may just reinforce your Judaism, whereas if a rabbi says, but this is a problem we have, you might be more open to listening to it because you share that same belief and therefore you're in the same circle and you'll listen, for example, to people in your family who say there are problems with the family, but when someone comes from outside, even if they give you a calm, rational explanation, you say, don't marry her. You say, somebody from outside the family can't actually criticize a family. So this idea of taking God's perspective seems to me very thematic and very beautiful because obviously we're in the same circle. So if you can do it, how do you do that? Like, how do you take God's perspective on your own life?
Well, so you can't, I can't, none of us can put ourselves in God's mind. But there are a few questions we can ask ourselves to push ourselves more in that direction. One of them is to recognize that God loves the other person in your story the same way God loves you. So even if that person wronged you, even that person rubs you the wrong way, that person is equally a child of God. And so sometimes I will make myself tell the story from their perspective. It's amazing what you can pick up if you force yourself to tell the story from the position of the other. And then the only other piece that I can offer, and there isn't much to go on here, but this is an art, not a science, is to see ourselves as constantly supple. And that, you know, one of the great rabbinic stories is why is it that we make the pen for writing the Sefer Torah out of the reed and not out of something sturdy, a chunk of walnut or oak or something? And the answer is given because the reed is flexible and it bends. And so you should write a book of rules, frankly, with something that can bend for reality's sake. So I think moving away from principles sometimes and standing in the fluidity of life, that also can help us.
I want to also ask you about, and first, I'm guessing that there's a division here, as there is among most people who hear what God's attitude is towards them, between those who favor the "you're already forgiven," as Rabbi Artson said it. By the way, I just want to say to the ushers, please allow people in while this is going on. No reason not to.
This is not Rabbi Wolpe's sermon, so you're
exactly. So it's perfectly all right, right, exactly. Because he's talking.
But come in while I'm talking.
And the whole child of God thing, you know, only goes so far. But the, we can talk about that later. So, the, some people like the "God has already forgiven you," as Rabbi Artson expressed it a moment ago. But my guess is that for some people, as they heard that, they thought, but where's the God who says, that was bad? You shouldn't have done that. That is, does the judgmental God also serve a purpose? The whole "I've already been forgiven" God, which is very therapeutic in every sense of that word, and very modern and very unjudgmental, is that, the first of all, is that the God of the tradition? And second, is that the God we need, or are most of us too quick to forgive ourselves?
So I think we are too quick to forgive ourselves. And I have 9 days to apologize for that crack, too.
Oh, that's, I'm quick to forgive. Myself.
Yeah. So, look, when I was a child, the most painful thing my mother could say to me was, she would say, "You know what is right. You decide." I hated when she did that. My mother's love was absolute. But because of that, I also knew she had very high standards, and she expected not to have to police them. She expected me to police myself. And I think that those people who take God's love as a carte blanche, do anything you want because God will love you anyway, are confusing an endless love with radical permissiveness. I don't believe God is permissive, and I don't think we should be permissive either. Ours are the prophets of Israel, who rail at the Jewish people for falling short of our best standards. But they do that because it is rooted in love. And that's a blend.
There's a Abraham Twersky, who's from a long line of Hasidic rabbis and is also a therapist. He said when he was a kid, his father, who was also a rabbi, wouldn't say what you did was bad or that you're bad. He would say what you did is not worthy of you, which is in the same tradition. So where do we start? Okay, we look back over the year. Our most common sin, I assume, are sins of speech, right? That's what we're most... So how do we begin this inventory? Let's say, okay, I want to do tshuva, I want to examine my deeds. Where do you suggest I start? In what like methodical way?
So when I talk to rabbinical students, what I tell them is I remind them that the Talmud says that not a day goes by that every single person violates the laws of speech. Every day. Each of us. I have never, ever regretted something that I haven't said. Ever. Several times a day.
No, I want to actually really put pressure on that statement.
Yeah.
Really, I certainly have regretted some things that I haven't said.
Okay.
All right, go ahead, continue.
lock the doors, give your speech. All right, so
much more often regretted, but
the nature of what I regret not having said, I can tell you, are two things. Moments where I thought to compliment someone,
right, that's,
and I didn't make the added effort to do it. You know, I often regret right before Yontif. There were two or three people I should have picked up the phone, or someone did something nice, and I just let it slip, and no one noticed it, but I noticed it. So I miss that a lot. And there have been times where I should have stood up for what I believed in, and I let someone silence me because it was awkward, it was easier, I felt alone, whatever. So those, yes, for sure. But there's a whole host of categories of times where I shot my mouth off and truly should just have stayed quiet. And often that's accompanied by a little tiny voice that says, are you really sure you want to say, oh. So I have never regretted not saying when that little tiny voice says, let it go.
Right. No, right? Neither have I.
So that's a good place to start. Thank you for the refining.
The whole counting to 10 thing is nobody does it, but it's very wise.
It's really, really.
Especially before you hit send.
Yes.
Trust me. Really.
Yeah, yeah,
step
yeah.
away from the computer, step away from the cell phone, yeah. Come back and read it later, or you will regret it.
Always a good idea.
Yeah.
The other thing I do want to add to that, I think that many of us turn this into something ritualized. And I want us, on this most ritual of occasions, to resist that. That in some weird way, Judaism is actually not a religion. And we've created the apparatus of a religion for which my accountant thanks you. But I'll let that sink in if you want. But what Judaism is a people's way of life. Right? And in that regard, teshuva can't be reduced to a formula. We need to face each moment fresh and say, what does this moment call me to do? And that kind of openness, this is about breaking open. This is about not letting life become habitual and about staying fresh at each moment. And that, I think, is the key. And otherwise, it becomes the one I will tell you, don't ever do this with me. This time of year, I am flooded by people who send me and 400 of the people in their address book an anonymous thing that says, if I may have wronged you in any way during the year, please forgive me. I must tell you, on God's behalf, you get no credit for such an email, none whatsoever, because frankly, if you don't know how you've offended me, that's offensive. And if you don't have the ability to come to me and say what it is you did to me, not to me and 300, I mean, frankly, if you offended us all the same way, you've got a bigger issue. But that's a substitute, Shuba. So it has to also be personal.
There is a question, actually, that arose in my mind when you were speaking about how Judaism is a way of life as opposed to a professionalized, ritualized event, which is to ask yourself in your daily life, what do you do or what decisions do you make because you're Jewish that you wouldn't make if you weren't? Is there a distinction? It's almost, I mean, Danny Gordas used to have a very nice, where he said, if Judaism were an indictable offense, how long would I have to follow you around before I could convict? Which is another way of putting it. That is, what evidence is there in your life that is different from the way your life would be from your non-Jewish neighbor in terms of the decisions you make and the things you do? We have a few minutes. If there's somebody who has a burning comment or question from this dialogue, I don't want to stifle you on this day of... if not, I have other questions for Rabbi Artson, but if there is, you're welcome to. On the other hand, if you don't want to take a chance... You sure? Okay, so yeah, go ahead. I'll repeat it, go ahead. The question was, since you really have never had the experience of not being Jewish, except for those of you who have,
right.
how would you know if you would react differently? And my answer to that, and then we'll take Rabbi Artzin's, and what I was intending was, there are societal norms. In what way are you countercultural? That's what I'm saying. If you live your life essentially the same as everybody around, except that you're in synagogue this morning and they're not, but then you're going to go out and eat the same thing at the same restaurant and go to the same shows and make the same decisions and send your kids to the same schools and give them the same education and on and on and on and on, then in what way is your life and your decision different because you're Jewish? That's my question.
And I want to offer a perhaps harsher rabbinic answer to that question. I grew up very assimilated. I grew up in a family of non-observant atheists in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is frankly as good a childhood as one can possibly have. And in a sense, I'm a convert in everything but name. And what converted me was not the Jewish people, although I love the Jewish people. What converted me was Torah. And Rav Sadia Gaon, 9th century Baghdadi, taught that we are a people by virtue of Torah. So when I ask, what would you do differently by virtue of being Jewish, I don't mean ethnically, right? Everyone at Sinai has experienced that there are enough different cultural chasms within the Jewish people that, you know, what one group looks at as Jewish food, another group sees as Scandinavian or Arab or whatever. So what links us all is a commitment to a certain high ethical standard that comes out of Torah and a sense of commandedness. And that sense of obligation gets frittered away when it becomes just ritual. How tightly do you put on the leather? How many times do you wobble back and forth with a prayer book? All of which I do, all of which is important. But all of that is a training ground for, do you really treat the stranger as though made in God's image? Do you really take seriously rising to care for the poor in your midst and the alien who dwells in your presence? Those kinds of commandments, that's what I would want Rabbi Gordas to be able to indict me for, and that's what I hold myself to at this season. It's not simple. The ritual is a training device to remind us to transform ourselves and the world.
And I'll add one more, since I spoke about this in terms of the Jewish community, for those of you who are here the first night of Rosh Hashanah, and also in a different way yesterday, which is that for the Jewish people, part of the way that you judge Jewishness is, do you care for the Jewish people? In the same way that in families, you judge your position in the family by how much you care for the family. It's not, I mean, ethical behavior in general is an important Jewish marker, but so is care for the Jewish people. So that, and that, for I think many people, that is the distinction between the way that they act generally and the Jewish part, is not that they don't have concern in general and for the world and so on, but there is this special familial sense and bond that ties them to the fate of Israel, the fate of the Jewish people, in a way that they don't generalize. And interestingly enough, I would also say that that's what ties Jews together in different places. Remember, I told that story yesterday about having been, I told it the first night Rosh Hashanah, that I was in Israel when Operation Solomon started, when Israel first went over to Ethiopia in the midst of a civil war. They sent Israeli agents with, you know, bagfuls of cash to buy off the freedom of all these people in Israel. And I remember I was in Israel at the time, it was in the 80s, and I was listening to the BBC, and the reporter said, characteristic of the BBC, I don't particularly like Israel, and I'm not a fan of this country. He said, but I have to admit, there's no other nation in the world or in history that would fly halfway across the world in the midst of a civil war to save people of a different race and a different language because they say, we are your sisters and brothers. And that special bond is among Jews is, I think, also part of the way you measure your Jewishness.
So couple years ago, I had the privilege of ordaining Uganda's chief rabbi, Rabbi Gershom Sizomo, whose group in Eastern Africa all became Jewish 70 years ago and are in the process of formalizing that. So we did 300 conversions. And the wonderful thing about being with the Jewish community in Uganda, all of whom are African, is they looked at my daughter and me and said, "You don't look Jewish." But we all looked Jewish when it came time for Shabbat. And we all looked Jewish. The Torah that I taught was not American Torah or California Torah. They learned the Torah that I taught because it's theirs as well. And I wanted my daughter to go to the ends of the world to see that we are brothers and sisters so long as we keep this way of life alive. In that case, you may look different, you may eat different foods, you may dress differently, but our core values, to the extent that they are the flowering of Torah, they keep us brothers and sisters around the globe, and there is no substitute. So part of teshuva is, teshuva literally means to turn, right? And to turn means to know where your center is. And it means to be able to change. Those of you who have ever done pottery on a wheel know that you lift the pot, the clay, you make a center mold of it, and then you lift it up. Right? So when you do that, you know where your center is. And so long as our center is Torah and each other, then we can grow in all kinds of different ways. And these 10 days should be a way of returning to the center.
And on that beautiful statement, we will thank Rabbi Artzin for engaging in the dialogue and thank all of you. Now back to our regularly scheduled service.